For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. For people who are new here, I'm Tygon Layton, the teacher here, and I'm very happy to have tonight as our guest speaker Zoketsu Norman Fisher, former abbot and current senior Dharma teacher of San Francisco Zen Center, head of Everyday Zen Foundation, prolific Zen author, and really a great innovator of Zen Buddhism in America, who's really opened up many ways of seeing Zen practice and is here tonight to talk about training in compassion and to bring us really an important aspect of how to bring practice to life. So thank you for coming.
Thanks, Tony. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. You could be somewhere else. I'd like to start with a brief guided meditation. Is that okay? Even though I know we just sat, but just for a few minutes. So return awareness to the body. Notice how simply doing that, simply bringing body and mind together in awareness, there's some stillness right away. Your body be uplifted from within. Feel how your upper body wants to lift and open so that the back part of your head is stretching up toward the sky with your chin tucked in and your chest and your heart open and light. Shoulders relaxed, spine lengthened. And you don't have to force that in some rigid way. If you allow it, the body will just open up like a flower. And feel how that is. Your breathing. Breath coming in, breath going out. Smooth breath all the way in. A smooth breath all the way out. And a wonderful rhythm of breathing. Breathe in, you literally, exactly, say yes to this next moment of life. And when you breathe out, you let go of this moment and everything extra. Just be present with everything open, your ears, the sensations of the body, your mind. If a thought comes, let it come and let it go. And notice how open, calm, and supportive is this awareness. It doesn't really have any boundaries. Anything can come and go. So this is what it feels like to be alive. The basic actual feeling of being alive, embodied, breathing, aware. That's the bottom line, isn't it, of being alive. And everything else, all of our problems, our accomplishments, our issues, our suffering, is all extra. And it all depends on this foundation of being alive. This boundless, open, presence. It's very concrete, very simple, and it's always right here. Thank you very much. So this feeling of being alive, this boundless awareness, is the source of compassion. Actually, it is compassion. Just this aliveness, just this embodiment, just this breath, just this almost ineffable space of awareness, it actually is compassion. In Zen, you know, there's a famous story about compassion. I'm sure you all know it. Yunyan and Dawu, Dharma brothers, and I think also biological brothers, are having a discussion about the bodhisattva of compassion that's often depicted with lots of arms and lots of heads, and each arm, in the palm of each hand, an eye. Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, hears the cries of the world, sees the suffering of the world, and her heart is open, she wants to help. So Yunyan asks his elder brother Dawu, how come the bodhisattva of compassion has so many hands and eyes? And Dawu says, oh, it's just like reaching back for your pillow in the dark. Just like reaching back for your pillow in the dark. Probably you've all had this experience, kind of half waking up in the middle of the night, and somehow your pillow is not just the way you want it. So you adjust it a little bit. Maybe you make it cooler and you turn it over. Did you ever notice that? And it's cool, it feels so nice. And then you fall back asleep. It's just an automatic, unconscious gesture that you do literally in your sleep, right? A simple, reflexive act of kindness toward yourself. Well, Dawu was saying, compassion is just like that. It's not a big deal. It's not a big, complicated, emotional, passionate thing. It's just our caring for each other, just helping each other, almost without even noticing what we're doing. It's just so natural that we would take care of each other. So Yunyan says, oh, I understand. Thank you, I understand. And Dawu says, what do you understand? And Yunyan says, the whole body is covered with hands and eyes. The whole body is covered with hands and eyes. Compassion is everywhere. Now I understand. Compassion is not this big deal. Compassion is everywhere. I see it everywhere. And Dawu says, that's really good. That's maybe 80%. Maybe 90, maybe 90%. Those of you who have elder brothers, you know how this goes. Pretty good, but only 90%. And Yunyan then says, respectfully to his older brother, what do you say? And Dawu says, the whole body is nothing but hands and eyes. Nothing but hands and eyes. As much as you think, Yunyan, there's compassion everywhere, it's more than you know. It's even more than you can imagine. Compassion is life. Compassion is being itself. When you really feel life, when you really appreciate, you know, what life is, it's breathing in and it's breathing out. It's saying yes to each moment and it's letting go each moment. When you really appreciate what life is, you understand that being itself is an ocean of compassion. And this is really, you know, something we're trying to realize and feel, not just think it, but feel it in our whole body through our practice. We're trying to understand our lives in that way, feel it in that way. Why is there anything at all? Did you ever think of that? There could be nothing. Nothing. And in a way, wouldn't that be more likely? It would be more likely, right, that there would be nothing. Nothing. Than that there would be all of this in its immense variety and complexity. How did that come to be? It makes more sense. There'd be nothing. But yet there's all this. There's this unbelievable bright world. There's this unbelievable you with your fingers and your fingernails and every hair on your head and the sun and the moon and the stars and the grass and the trees and the flowers and all of your projects and all of your confusion and all of your joy and all of your longing and grief. How could that be? It's all compassion. It arises out of compassion. It's all a wonder. And that's what we come to recognize and come to feel little by little on our cushions. But that's just one side. The other side is, you know, how do we live and enact this compassion? And how can we survive this broken world? Because, you know, we all have to be honest here and notice that even though it's a wonderful idea, we can maybe agree with it and even glimpse it for a moment, that everything is compassion, that being is compassion, we have to be honest and notice that we don't really feel that most of the time, you know? We don't walk around feeling that. And we certainly couldn't say that we're living it. Most of the time, we're in some mundane prison of our mind, of ourself. Most of the time, we're being spun around by our isolation, by our self-defensiveness, by our fear, by our resentment, by our confusion. That's what mostly goes on, you know, by our sense of despair about the world's prospects and maybe our own. So even though maybe we could accept, yes, it's true, we're always swimming in an ocean of compassion, we have to admit we don't really know that. We don't really feel it. That's not what our life is like. That's why we need some practice, we need some training. We need to understand better so that we can have access to the compassion that's all around us and in us and that is us, so we can overcome our strong fear and our resistance. How come we're resistant? We're resistant because compassion means suffering. Actually, compassion is suffering. The willingness to turn toward suffering, to take in our own suffering honestly, and then also the suffering of others. And we don't want to do that. We're scared to do that. So we're trying to protect ourselves from our own suffering and the suffering of others, and it's not working. It's not working. So on the one hand, we could say it really is true. There's no suffering. Being arises and passes away like a dream. Life just floats on. And that's compassion. And everything is basically okay. On the other hand, there's lots of suffering. We don't get what we want. We can be lonely and afraid. We suffer when we're sick. We suffer when we're old. We suffer when we die. There's lots of loss and pain and sorrow. So what are we going to do? We have to undertake spiritual practice, so we can learn how to embrace our life as it truly is, so that we can see through the clinging and the delusion that creates this world of pain. And once we do that, our hearts will fall wide open and we will actually feel the love and the compassion that's inherent in our being itself. And then we will be able to take in the suffering, our own suffering, the suffering of our friends, the suffering of our acquaintances, and of the world. And it will be perfectly okay. We'll be able to do that, and we will even be able to appreciate the beauty of it that we will be able to see through the tears. So I've been studying last few years an Indo-Tibetan text, which is a great manual, very famous text, and a manual for how to generate compassion, how to work on ourselves so that we can bring compassion to mind and heart. Now, as I'm saying, Zen practice specializes in this wide, wide, wide compassion. The only point, actually, of sitting on our cushions and bowing and offering incense and chanting and sitting more is compassion, so that we can recognize the compassion that is our lives. But it's all implicit. It's all quiet. So I thought it would be good to study a more noisy Tibetan text that's waving its arms and jumping up and down all about compassion. I think it's good remedial work for us Zen students. Because I think we often miss the point, you know, that compassion is what this is all about. And sometimes we get fixated on the rules and the difficulty, you know, of doing the practice. And we forget. This has always only been about compassion. So I started studying this text and I went around to all of our different groups, everywhere I went, talking about it. And students made really liked it, and they made transcripts of my talks, and I was very moved by that, because it's hard to make transcripts. I would never do that. It's too much work, you know. It's very easy to give a talk compared to transcribing a talk. You know, you have to take time to type every word and editing. So I was very moved that they made all these transcripts, and out of the transcripts I made this book. Indo-Tibetan title, it's a short text actually. It's called 7 Points of Mind Training, or Heart Training, because mind and heart is the same word. 7 Points of Mind Training. And there are 59 slogans, 59 short, pithy practice sayings, maybe like aphorisms, that you are to memorize, reflect on, think about, drill yourself in them until they become your own thought and second nature to your mind, so that they'll pop up in the middle of your life unbidden, you know, just at the time when you're in some moment of forgetting that you're actually practicing, and all of a sudden the slogan pops up in your mind. Oh yeah, that's right. And then you reorient. So that's the idea. You would drill and train in these slogans. So the 59 slogans are organized under 7 points. So I'll just briefly tell you the 7 points, and then I thought I would read some from the book under one of the points. So the first point is resolve to begin. Resolve to begin. Because if you want to undertake compassion training and you're really serious about it, you have to begin by examining your motivation. Seriously examining. That means examining your life. You know, what's important to me? What am I really doing here? Why would I do this training? And how important is it in the priorities that I have in my life? And I think that truly most of us are not clear about what we're doing with our lives, because no one encourages us to think that through. It's kind of like life just slides along like an assembly line, and you're going from one thing to the next, because everybody does that, right? When you get through the fifth grade, you don't think, do I really want to go to the sixth grade? Or why would I do that? No, you just go to the sixth grade, the seventh, and all the way up. Sometimes, like, 50 years goes by, and you just think, okay, what happened? What was I doing? So you have to stop and really examine, you know, what is this about? And if I were up to undertake this training, why would I do that? And how does that fit into what I need to do in my life? So there's a whole slogan and practice there for undergoing that reflection. So first point, resolve to begin. Second point is called training in compassion. And then there's two parts to it. Absolute compassion and relative compassion. And I'm going to read you a section from my introduction to that part to explain the difference between those two. The third point is turn all difficulties into the path. A lot of people, you know, sometimes you'll see somebody and they'll say, oh, hi, you know, I haven't seen you in a long time. I haven't been to the Zendo in, you know, many months. Like, actually, maybe it was like a decade I haven't been around there. Because I've been having a hard time. Things have been going really haywire in my life, so I haven't really been able to get to the Zendo. But it's the opposite. It should be the opposite, right? When you're having a hard time, when things are all falling to pieces and it's very difficult, that's when you should be doing the practice. That's because those are the things that give you what you need practice, but usually we don't think that way. We need to have some training to understand how to make our difficulties into the path. So that's the third point. And there's a bunch of slogans under that point. And the fourth point is make practice your whole life. At home in Everyday Zen, I always tell people, you know, this is coming here is not the practice. That's not the practice. Sitting on the cushion actually isn't the practice. You only come here to remind you that your life is the practice. And probably it helps you. Coming here helps you to remember that your life is the practice. All of your life, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from the first breath to the last. That's your practice. The way you live your life, the quality of attention, the quality of heart, how much love you bring to everything you do, that's your practice. And you won't be able to do that practice unless you have some training and make some effort. So under this fourth point, we learn how to extend the practice into our whole life. The fifth point is called assess and extend. Because we have to have some way of noticing how we're doing, assessing how we're doing. When we fall off, knowing what that feels like and know how to get back on track. So there's a bunch of slogans that help us with that. The sixth point is discipline of relationship. Because, again, we all have this idea that our spiritual practice is a private affair. It's a very American idea. It's private, you don't talk about it in public. It's more embarrassing than talking about sex or money, isn't it? You do not talk about your spiritual practice, and you shouldn't, because it's private. It's your own business. You know, maybe you don't even talk about it with your family members. But no, actually, your practice is your relationships. Every single human interaction, particularly the significant relationships in your life, that's where you really find out how to practice. And that's where your practice is most fruitful and most challenging, in all of your human relationships. And I like to point out the obvious fact, which most people don't notice, that the basic form of Zen literature is conversations between friends. You know, it's not treatises. I mean, there are some treatises, but the classical literature, the koan literature, the Zen stories, are all interactive, right? They're dialogue, dialogic literature. Because it's about relationship. The truth doesn't, although we might think, oh, that like in some of the stories, well, the teacher has the truth and the student doesn't have the truth. But actually what the stories are saying is, when the two of them encounter each other, truth arises as a result of their encounter. Because relationship, not only relationship to people, that's very important, obviously, but also relationship to everything. The eye's relationship to an object of sight, the ear's relationship to a sound. Living is related, right? We don't live isolated. Every moment of perception and even thought is a moment of relationship. Especially our human relations are fruitful for practice. So the sixth point is the discipline of relationship. And the seventh point is living with ease in a crazy world. Because the world really is crazy. We have to admit that. When you look at the newspaper, you could scratch your head and think, how could such a thing happen? But that doesn't mean that we have to be crazy or that we have to be destroyed by the crazy world. We can live with ease and with some happiness, even looking at the world as it really is, especially when we look at the world as it really is, taking in the suffering, we can have some real happiness. So those are the seven points. So I thought I would read you... How long is this supposed to go on?
Well, this should be time for discussion, too. So okay, I'm going to talk another 10 minutes.
Okay.
Talk, discussion.
Yeah, so I'll read you a little bit, and then we'll talk. So this is from my introduction to the second point, train in empathy and compassion. In English, there are at least three words that describe the capacity to feel the feelings of others. Empathy is the capacity to feel somebody else's feelings. And this requires that we not be so self-absorbed that we are tone deaf to the experiences of others. Most people, unfortunately, without realizing it, are living Bette Midler's old joke. And I'm sure you all know this joke. Okay, enough about me. Let's talk about what you think about me. And isn't that true? You know, like, that's how we access the feelings of others. Like, I wonder if she's mad at me. I wonder if she was happy with the present I gave her. In other words, the feelings of others are of interest to us when they relate to us. Otherwise, you know, we have no idea what's going on with anybody else. And that's not empathy, right? That's really basically seeing others through the lens of ourselves. Empathy is when we can set aside our own interests and our own ideas long enough to actually notice what somebody else is feeling, what they're going through internally without any reference to ourselves. But you can be empathetic, I think, without really caring. You can be good at sensing what people are feeling just enough to be able to control them or manipulate them for your own interests. Con artists and sociopaths probably have a lot of empathy. They're really good at feeling the feelings of others. I know some people like that. They really, really are astute. Quite astonishingly astute at feeling the feelings of others, but they don't really care, actually, about the others. They're interested in figuring out what's going on and making use of it, but they don't necessarily care. So let's use the word sympathy to mean feeling the feelings of others, but caring, really wanting others to be well and to be happy, not wanting to make use of them for one's own ends. And then we can use the word compassion, as I said before, specifically to mean sympathy for another person when they're suffering, when they're in pain. So, compassion is actually kind of uncomfortable. I mean, a lot of people like compassion and think of themselves as being compassionate, but when you really scratch the surface, the truth is they're not willing to go there where somebody has pain. They're willing to send flowers and send cards and, oh, I feel so sorry for her. But they're not really willing to go over to the side of the pain because it's hard and it's uncomfortable. We don't want to feel pain. Almost everything in our lives is dedicated to avoiding pain. So compassion is a little difficult. In Mahayana Buddhism, the term that designates this arising in the heart of the desire to connect to other people in compassion, to really care about other people, and including their suffering, is called bodhicitta. The word bodhicitta literally means impulse or desire or commitment for spiritual awakening, which doesn't sound like compassion, does it? But implicit in the Mahayana Buddhist understanding of spiritual awakening is the thought that spiritual awakening means awakening to a heartfelt concern for others. That's what you're awakening to. Since any selfish effort, even with the goal of wisdom or enlightenment for oneself, would never lead to actual awakening. It would only lead to more rarefied, spiritualized forms of self-clinging. So cultivating bodhicitta means cultivating true and heartfelt concern for others in a way that's not clingy or arrogant, but is based on the accurate wisdom that none of us is alone. There's no such thing as an atomized human being. And in the Zen story of Buddha's awakening, as you know, Buddha does not say, as you think, we might think he would say, I'm now awakened. What's wrong with all these other dummies? They should also awaken. The Buddha does not say that. The Buddha, at the moment of his awakening, in the Zen story, says, wonderful, wonderful, all sentient beings now in this moment with me are awakened. That's what he says. Because that's what he awakens to, a sense of solidarity and identity with others. So the essence of bodhicitta, the essence of awakening, is love and concern for others. And this love is based on the feeling, based on the recognition, the understanding that's not only in the mind, but also in the heart and in the whole body, that what we call self and what we call others are actually designations, concepts, habits of mind, not realities of the world. Real altruism, in other words, is not, as we think it is, self-sacrifice for the benefit of others, a guilt-driven sense that we should be good, we should be nice, we should be kind. No, it's the profound recognition that self and other are not fundamentally different, only apparently different. And because of this, the range of activity and feeling of bodhicitta is much wider than we would expect. And a whole world of altruism and its effects opens up before us. Now we see that the only way that we could love ourselves is by loving others. And the only way that we could really and truly love others is loving ourselves. That these two things are actually not different things. And once we really understand this, and we take this truth into our hearts, our life changes. Once we open up to this, it becomes absolutely impossible to go back. It becomes impossible to fool ourselves anymore with our selfish and resentful thoughts. Now, of course, we'll still have selfish and resentful thoughts, but now we'll understand them for what they are. And we'll see how stupid this is, how childish this is, how blind this is. And that wouldn't be so bad if it weren't also painful. We feel the worst pain, you know, when we feel angry or envious or jealousy. It's worse for us now. Because we realize this is totally not the way things are. It's stupid. And look what I'm doing to myself. So even though we might still have those feelings, we can no longer affirm them. We can no longer be willfully, intentionally aggressive. We can no longer be willfully, intentionally disrespectful, because we can see with our eyes in just the same way that we can see the sky and the sun setting, that all of life is one big sky warmed by one sun. And when we separate ourselves from one another, it just is not right. It's not true. So there's no way that we can go on and on with our hatred, our resentment, our self-centeredness. It's not compelling anymore. It's painful. And little by little, over time, it falls away. And we understand that love is not some nice emotional option that sometimes we feel, or we wish we could feel, or we wish someone would feel in relation to us. We realize that love is the most fundamental fact of life, and that it's a fact of life that we desperately need to conform to. Otherwise, we'll perish. So earlier in my talk, I was really talking about absolute and relative bodhicitta. Absolute bodhicitta is seeing that all of being is love. Relative bodhicitta is rolling up our sleeves and actually loving somebody, and helping somebody, and doing something to change the world for the better. Not out of anger, not out of fear, but out of love. So that our helping is sustainable. And we go on and on helping. We don't think we need to be successful at it. We just think we need to keep doing it. our whole life through, and the next life, and the next, and the next, and the next. Because that's the commitment of bodhicitta. And we can sustain it because of absolute bodhicitta, because we come back to our cushions again and again, and we feel this open-heartedness that literally has no boundary. So, okay. What would you like to say?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Comments, questions, responses for Norman, please feel free. Don't be shy. Please.
I've always worked in a nonprofit field, and I was drawn to that to help others. I think one of the questions I have is, how do you maintain joy in your life when you put yourself in a place of suffering to be with suffering? Sometimes I feel like I can get dragged down through it,
yeah,
too, and there's sort of no escape from it. It just all becomes bleak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the most important issues of this training. And that's where the balance between relative and absolute bodhicitta comes in. Some of the slogans under the category of absolute bodhicitta are slogans like, see everything as a dream. See everything as a dream. Rest in the openness of mind. So in other words, we have to cultivate that side of our practice. And this is really where we can do strong work on the cushion. Cultivate that side of our practice that makes us realize that suffering is love. Suffering is not a tragic flaw that we have to remove, and it's up to us to remove it. And the more we remove, the more of it there is, and the more we get dragged down by it. But suffering is life's natural opportunity. And we, as loving bodhisattvas, are dedicated to alleviating suffering, but we don't hate the suffering, and we don't think that the suffering is our enemy to be excised. Our coming together because of suffering is how we meet each other and how we love each other. It's an opportunity. Suffering is always an opportunity. Suffering is always love. And it's hard to see that, you know, to be sure. So that's why we keep coming back to our practice. I mean, my observation is that the only people that I've ever seen who can successfully sustain with good spirit and joy a life of helping other people are people who have some kind of spiritual or religious perspective. It's almost universally the case. Obviously, they're not all Zen Buddhists, you know, they have other spiritual perspectives, but they have that kind of faith. And so, you know, maybe that's why you're here, you know, so that you can develop that side of your life to sustain a life of helping. Absolutely. And it's an ongoing project. And I think that the art here for you would be, for instance, to notice the signs in yourself of feeling burdened. Notice them long before the feeling of burdensomeness arises, and begin to practice with those feelings, to be able to identify them and practice with them and see where they come from and how to release them before they become burdensome. And that would be the fruit of your awareness and of your ongoing practice. And then, of course, you know, we come to the cushion, and, you know, on the cushion we sometimes suffer a lot, right, because a lot of things come up. But usually we burn through that suffering, and then we open out into a big field, a boundless field of awareness and a boundless field of love, and then we really feel that, and we feel renewed and enriched through our practice. So you're in the right place. You're doing the right thing. You'll be fine. Yeah.
Another comment. Yes, Kim.
Very nice talk, Kim. There's a Tibetan practice called taking and giving.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that? And especially in the context of like spiritual purity, sometimes there's the idea that, you know, we work towards spiritual purity, but when you take on somebody's suffering, that seems to smack of something different.
Well, that practice is the most famous practice of this text. I didn't talk about it tonight, because if I bring it up, it takes a longer time to do justice to it, so I didn't bring it up. But that is, the practice of sending and receiving is the main meditation practice suggested in this text. And it's under the category of relative bodhicitta, where there is suffering that you take in. But also it has elements of absolute bodhicitta in it to make it possible for you to do that. And the practice essentially involves, as you said, literally taking in the suffering of others and transforming that suffering through one's own body, with a capital B, into healing and sending out healing to the people who you have in mind. So it's a powerful practice taking in suffering, sending out healing, taking in suffering, sending out healing. It's a beautiful practice. It takes some time to develop it, but it's a wonderful practice. And then once you develop it, you can do it anytime. If you're in the middle of a difficult situation, in that moment you can breathe in the suffering, breathe out relief. So is that enough of an explanation that makes sense?
I think so.
Yeah, and I don't think the practice is usually presented as a practice of purity or impurity. It's just it's a compassion practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'll mention that this is in the book Training in Compassion Zen Teaching of the Practice of Lojong, which Norman has written, and we have copies available for sale after the talk, so I'll just mention that. Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering if you might say more about the resolve to begin. I mean, just the idea of checking in with, or just really seeing how our whole life is our practice, and you know, because one of the things, when I contemplate compassion, I'm often thinking about this very troubled condominium complex I live in, where there are these various factions, and there's a lot of tension, and there's this little cat that's cost $3,000 worth of imagined sort of emotional damage. I mean, but it feels, well, like this little cat sits under the bush, and people are really upset about it, and they're all, you know, it's real upset, though, and it feels to me very much like the world, which is that there's so much of, you know, just these decisions that people make about each other, and I feel often very dwarfed and I feel very uncertain about how to, you know, respond and what would be skillful, and, you know, and I often just feel just really lost. So I was just wondering, the condominium complex thing was just an acknowledgement that there are so many parts of our lives where the sense of what would we even begin, I don't know, just the sense of lostness, I guess, mm-hmm. when it comes to compassion and something real. Mm-hmm. That wasn't...
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess maybe the simplest thing is to intentionally recall that everybody in any situation of conflict between people, that everybody is suffering, and that probably what they're fighting about is not actually what's bothering them, right? I mean, I think, one of the things I do is work with conflict resolution professionals who do mediation and work in high conflict situations. So I've learned a lot about conflict from them. And pretty much it comes down to that. If you want to solve a conflict, just remember, it's not about what it looks like it's about. So as a practice, maybe we can't say that to people, because a lot of times they get mad at you if you say that. No, it's about the cat. It's about the cat. What are you talking about? You know, no, it's the cat. You know, so it doesn't work necessarily. So, you know, this is not really about the cat. Oh, yes, it is. It doesn't work. But in your belly, in your heart and in your belly, you can really literally connect to the person who's in suffering and grief, even if they're yelling at you, because you own the cat. You own the cat.
Well, there are actually two cats. My cat is now hanging out in a tent on my porch. But there's this other little cat. So my cat has been part.
Yes, he has. I just figured that. So in other words, at the moment that somebody's coming after you because of your cat, this is the challenge. At that moment, can you connect to that person without wordlessly, maybe, in your belly and your heart, and look at that person and see, here's a suffering person. Who knows what has happened to them in their life, causing them to be so upset about this little cat? And you have to see that person and not the aggressive person who's after you about your cat. And once you can see that person, then they're still yelling at you and you still have to do something about the cat, but you no longer have that horrible feeling of living in a world full of aggressive, threatening people who are unreasonably out to get you. That's the worst feeling, right? So you change that. This is a practice for changing the world into a world that is full of brothers and sisters who you are connected to deeply and who you love. You'll still have controversies and problems with them, but you won't have that sinking feeling of, you know, living in a threatening world. You actually transform the world into a much happier world by transforming your own mind and your own heart. And this requires a very, you know, thoroughgoing understanding of the process by which we create our world and reversing that. So there's a lot of slogans, actually, that relate to how to handle. All the slogans under the category of discipline of relationship are about that. You know, talk about different ways that we could practice specific slogans so that we could transform the way we look at other people in relation to ourselves. So that's very important, yeah. Conflict is a huge thing in our lives, right? We're always in conflict with somebody. Yeah.
So maybe one more, we'll have a chance for informal discussion, but maybe one more before we close formally, one more. Bill?
Just off of what you just said, I try to not hate people, even some who are almost begging to be hated. but I do hate the capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that it's right to hate it, and that for the love of people, I should hate it.
Mm-hmm.
But I wondered what you would say about it.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by hate, exactly?
Feel that it is hateful and should be done away with.
Uh-huh. Because uh-huh.
That's simply counterproductive. I could understand that.
Yeah.
But it seems very worthy of hatred, because it treats everything as an object to be used up and thrown away.
Uh-huh. Well, I thought about this a lot, you know, and if hatred is a destructive force in oneself, I want to destroy something. I want to dismantle something. I've got this furious energy to dismantle something and do violence to it. It's probably not helpful for you, or certainly for anybody else. But I distinguish between that and what sounds more like, you know, you use the word hate, but it may be more like righteous indignation. This is something that's wrong. I want to rouse up as much energy as I can to oppose this which is wrong. And there may not be, you know, an aggressive need in there to destroy someone or something, but there is a powerful energy and a fierceness to overcome something that is not beneficial to other people. The trouble with the capitalist system is that it doesn't really exist. It's an abstraction, right? You have people who, I don't know, run banks or manipulate money and so on. You have people, and you have institutions, which are buildings, I guess, with people in them. And so the capitalist system is a kind of word, it's a concept that we put on many countless interactions. So hating the capitalist system is kind of a weird thing, because you're hating a concept in a way, So I don't know. I don't know. I mean, because I could imagine somebody hating the capitalist system in a way that's very wholesome and that will lead to good results. I could also imagine somebody hating the capitalist system in a way that becomes obsessive, aggressive, crazy-making, and destructive in the end, you know, killing people, you know, and all that. And the kind of, like, you know, blowing up a building on Wall Street with people in it wouldn't end the capitalist system, probably, and it would be harmful to people, and it would be harmful to the person who put the bomb in there. So that would be an act of hatred in my book. Yeah.